think that Columbus enjoyed most of his journeys, or Magellan, I'm sure they were miserable for 99.9% of their time on these poor wooden ships. These guys were miserable.
Hello, welcome to episode 56 of the MedTech Podcast. You join me, your host, Karandeep Singh Badwell. And in this episode, we have Ziv Ekiteli, CEO of Montfort, a company that turns any standard smartphone into a sophisticated, personalized neurological medical testing device for remote and in-person testing, the data of which can be used for monitoring of neurological and psychiatric patients. Ziv started his career as an electrical engineer. Having experienced one of his teachers suffer from ALS, he began to study neurology alongside engineering, eventually going on to study a PhD in brain science alongside his engineering career, and then going on to co-found Montfort. In this episode, we discuss his journey from studying medicine and engineering to connecting neurology and technology, the prevalence of neurological conditions affecting up to 1 in 8 people, how the number of neurologists per capita is falling, and his advice for aspiring entrepreneurs to first begin by studying within the box before thinking outside of it. Welcome to the show, Ziv. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure having you on. So many people, of course, are familiar with telehealth and neurology. What exactly is teleneurology?
So teleneurology is actually a part of telehealth that, simply put, we address people with neurological and, to some extent, psychiatric conditions. Anything that is related to the brain, these people, there are millions of them that need to be treated remotely, and teleneurology is the discipline of allowing this kind of treatment to be taken outside of the clinic.
So is this a term that you came up with, or is this an industry term?
It is, I think that for the most part today, it's quite common. There's just like there's telecardiology and telediabetes. These are more, I would say, advanced disciplines in the medical world that started providing a remote service to the patients in these domains. So these are more common, but I think that now teleneurology is becoming more and more common. Many people are using it. There are many companies who are providing services and products in these domains. So I think that it will be a standard very quickly.
So, of course, the pandemic forced a lot of us to start using teleservices because that was the only option during the time of lockdowns. Do you feel as though the pandemic has helped accelerate this work towards going towards a tele remote-based system?
So I think that what happened during the pandemic is that indeed it forced people to be treated remotely because people were not able to go to the clinics. And by the way, this had devastating results. I think that not only in neurology, I think many more people died and suffered from the lack of treatment to the conditions they already had than due to the virus itself. So by shutting down the clinics and focusing only on COVID and preventing people from coming to the clinics, I think that many more people died from existing conditions rather than the new conditions. So what happened was that indeed, in many cases, people were, by being driven outside of the clinic, people started to think about new solutions. And for the most part, it ended up with video conferences. So instead of meeting the patient face-to-face, a lot of doctors in all disciplines started to have this kind of assessments remotely. And based on their best efforts, treated the patients as the conditions are changing. And what happened after the pandemic is that in those conditions where video is insufficient for proper assessment, we saw a shift right back to the old practices. And neurology is a very good example for that, because if you were a neurologist and you'd wanted to evaluate my gait, for example, or my tremor, or bradykinesia, or cognitive functions, it's virtually impossible to do it by Zoom. There are some very few questions that you can ask, and maybe some things you can ask me to do, like, you know, do this tapping test, and even that is limited by the bandwidth, camera quality, etc. So other than that, it's almost impossible for a neurologist to evaluate a person by Zoom. And immediately when clinics were reopened, we saw people going straight back to the clinics, and the Zoom thing was done with. You could see it also in the economical performance of companies who provided telehealth, because people realized that all they did essentially was to have this kind of virtual connection, but they didn't solve the real need of the physicians to have a quantitative and reliable assessment of the patient at home. So when the pandemic was done, all of the disciplines in medicine where video was not sufficient and isn't sufficient to evaluate the patient, people went straight back to the clinic. And what Montfort is doing is to allow the physician to sit in, for example, where you're sitting, and get an inclusive report for the patient condition, all of these symptoms that I mentioned, like tremor and balance and cognitive functions, and then have, if needed, a virtual meeting relying upon the markers that the physician now has, and then they can provide teleneurology service. This was already accomplished in cardiology and diabetes, for example, where a doctor can sit anywhere on the planet, get a report for a patient, and based on the results that they have, can make treatment adjustments, diagnostics, etc.
So, of course, an important part of telehealth is technology. Do you feel as though people around the world have the technology to accept telehealth, or do you feel as though hospitals need to essentially upgrade the infrastructure to work with this?
So, the positive side is that we're not the first ones to do telehealth. So these disciplines that I mentioned, there are already devices and already doctors and hospitals that are getting more and more used to relying upon these devices for their diagnostics, for their treatment adjustment, to monitor the patient using these kind of devices. It can be as simple as a smartwatch that measures your heart rate variability, etc. So it's becoming, I think, more and more acceptable in general. In neurology, it's more challenging, just like it is more challenging in anything, because we're addressing the brain, which is the most complex and sensitive organ in our body. This is why things take longer in this particular domain. So in neurology, it's more challenging, but we kind of ride the tide of telehealth in general, and the fact that hospitals are getting used to it, the fact that there is reimbursement, there are existing CPTs codes that can get the hospital paid for remote patient monitoring and telehealth in general. So in that sense, this is more easy now than before. But again, because neurology is a very complex domain, it involves a huge number of conditions. The brain is the single organ in our body with the largest number of different conditions. And the symptoms are very different. There is a lot of motor symptoms, a lot of cognitive symptoms, a lot of affective or mood-related symptoms all originate in the brain. Of course, a lot of physiological properties to figure out. So neurology is a more complex situation. So this is why teleneurology within the telehealth is more challenging and takes more time.
So in a past conversation, you stated that not many people are aware how prevalent neurological conditions are. Would you say this is a factor as to why not more people are trying to tackle this condition in comparison to something like cardiology, which is quite well known?
So, first of all, as I mentioned, I think a key part of neurology being lagging behind, definitely, and I need to stress that point, definitely outside of the clinic. Inside the clinic, and that's maybe the paradox, inside the hospitals, like functional MRI and deep brain stimulation, these are the most advanced technology that people have ever invented. That's it uses the very far edge of technology, and we see amazing accomplishments. So there's a huge investment there and huge progress in anything related to neurology in the clinic, however, in the hospital. However, in the large number of patients, the mass volume of chronic neurological conditions, and especially outside of the clinic, there's very little progress because of the complexity and sensitivity of the brain. So that's one reason. The fact that indeed people are not aware of the scale of this problem is yet another reason for why it is addressed less than it should. People with neurological conditions, because of primarily, I think, social reasons, they tend to seclude in their own homes. Very often they would stop working, they would feel ashamed of their condition. You don't see a person with diabetes or with a cardiovascular condition ashamed of their condition, the fact that they have symptoms, they may have disabilities, they consume drugs, but they're not ashamed to be a part of society. I think in neurological conditions, this is why we don't see as many patients out there as there are. There are about one out, it depends who you ask, but it's between 1 out of 8 to 1 out of 10 people who live today suffer from a neurological condition. And again, there's a huge variety of different conditions, from epilepsy through movement disorders like Parkinson's disease and Huntington's disease, all the way to schizophrenia and clinical depression. So we're not aware of these numbers, even due to the huge magnitude, because of the reasons that I mentioned. And I think that this is preventing this particular domain, with the extra complexity of handling the brain, to the fact that it's not addressed as much as it should, and definitely as much as the economical and medical impact that neurological conditions impose on society.
So from working in telehealth, what's been the response with the physicians that you're working with? Are they welcoming this, or are they perhaps a little bit afraid that this may take their jobs away? What's been your view on this?
I don't think that any neurologist is worried about their job security for the mere reason that for every patient that they see, there are about 20 that wait in line asking to be seen. So, and this is getting worse. The number of neurologists per capita is dropping, and per patient with the aging of population is dropping even more for reasons that I don't think we should discuss now. But at any event, I don't think, and I've never met a neurologist that was their concern. Their concern at the beginning was, is this accurate enough? They were used to evaluate patients in the clinic with their own eyes, and maybe a stopwatch, and maybe a piece of paper. So that was relatively easy to convince them that not only that we're as accurate as they are, we are more accurate. And we can easily see how any test that a neurologist can rate visually, we do much more accurately, which means that it's a quantitative and not a personal impression on a very rude scale of tremor, for example, between 0 and 4. We measure the tremor exactly. So not only that it's more accurate, we see we are able to provide more components, more important digital endpoints from each test. So if the only outcome that you could measure from a test that is called timed up and go, there is a routine, you stand up from a chair, you walk, you turn, you sit back. If the only quantitative assessment that the physician could measure was the completion time, and then in a couple of notes they would say something about the steps and maybe balance, etc., we provide a detailed account for the entire protocol, including things that the physician has no way of measuring. So we were able to demonstrate that first we're in correlation to what they're observing, but wherever there was a dedicated lab to conduct the same test, we demonstrated that we're as accurate as that lab. So I think we've passed that first gap, and they trust what we do, and this was a part of the reason why we have FDA clearance, and which further increases their confidence. Then the question was, can they rely on the same tests being taken at home? And we were able to do that as well, demonstrate that it is accurate. There are glitches, sometimes there are problems. We a part of what we do is to recognize these erroneous tests if they happen, and be able to screen them out, maybe ask the patient to repeat it. So I think that even in that case, the physicians rely more and more about what we do, and they need it, because they will tell you that the last place that they want to evaluate the patient is in the clinic. Because in the clinic, it's a random time that doesn't represent the patient's real life. It has the white coat effect. People are getting prepared for the test days ago. Maybe they slept in a bus and took an hour to find parking, or sometimes even flying over. So the test in the clinic doesn't represent the true nature of the patient condition. Neurologists know it. So it took us some time to convince them that the tests that we provide at home are accurate and reliable as well. And I'll just mention that the last part of our journey is to convince them that they can also rely on passive assessment of patient as they text regularly or walk with the device or doing some things with some other apps, that this can also tell the physicians important information about the patient condition without the need to do an active test. So this would be the last, I think, step or the last effort that we need to convince patients. But so far, it's been going along well, and we don't see concerns from neurologists. Definitely not worried about us taking their job.
So having started your career as an electrical engineer, what is it about neurology that attracted you to not only begin studying in this field, but also to start a business in this sector?
So, I was one of the kids that played with Lego and disassembled any electronic device at my parents' home. Sometimes I was also able to reconstruct it, but not that often. So engineering was always something that attracted me. The first time that I started thinking about the brain and got interested in anything related was when my high school teacher, my math teacher, his name was Yair Cohen. He was a person that I really loved. He was diagnosed with ALS, and me and some friends of mine witnessed his very sad journey until he died. And that, because I cared about him a lot, it was the first thing that got me intrigued to figure out what was going on. Contemplating between studying medicine and brain surgery for some time and engineering, I decided to stick with engineering, but from the very beginning, I was already hooked to understand the brain, which is also an electrical device, electrical and chemical device by its nature. That's what's most amazing about it. So I started to learn these two disciplines, and from very early, I connected between neurology and technology. I studied all the basics in both domains, also in the Faculty of Medicine, and connected neurons and transistors with the nanowire, then a multi-electrode array and a PC, all the way to the entire brain with electrocorticography for epileptic seizures solutions. So this was my main interest for ever since I started studying.
I completely agree with you. When you have the right teachers at school, they can really help your path in the future. Yeah. You know, when you have somebody that you really look up to and, you know, understands your ambition. So yeah, I really appreciate the fact that you mentioned this teacher and how they change your life effectively. So following on from that, having worked in this industry for nearly 20 years, of course, you went on to entrepreneurship, you started your own company. For the listeners today that want to go into entrepreneurship, what were the mistakes that you made early on in your career? And question number two, of course, is how do you truly determine whether entrepreneurship is for you or not? Because entrepreneurship is not for everybody, let's face it.
Right. So I think that the first lesson that I learned, and this is a tip that I always give to people who contemplate about doing something new, is I call it know the box. We are constantly being told to think outside of the box. I've never seen anyone who could think outside of the box unless they know the box perfectly. They need to know any corner inside the box. You see it in art. For example, you look at Picasso's paintings. So at the beginning, you think the last things that he's done, you think it doesn't look like a grown-up even, let alone a famous painter. But when you see their history, that guy knew everything. He could paint everything perfectly until he ended up with knowing all the box. He got stuck within those limits. And then he had to invent and start thinking outside of the box. I see the same thing in entrepreneurship, in successful entrepreneurs. These are guys that know by themselves or with their partners, they know every corner of the box, and only then they start to reach out outside of the box and explore it. I don't think, it doesn't guarantee that if you know the box, you will succeed. There's a lot of other things to make a startup successful, but if you are working outside of a box that you don't know well, it's very unlikely that you will be able to compete with all those people who are expert in that domain. You can always launch a successful game that will a lot of people would like and just by accident. But that also is very unlikely. And definitely in the world of anything related to the medical industry, I think you need to be an expert or bring expertise to what you're doing. And if you're not able to do it, most likely you would fail. So that's one of the things I think that I first learned and the first thing that I would recommend. Second, I would say mistake that I've made is not to identify a very specific beachhead to take over. The very nature of startups is that they offer a wide potential of possibilities, wide range of possibilities. And it's okay to start like that, but the sooner you identify the beachhead that you can take, the better, and it will make your endeavor more successful or more likely to succeed. No one can guarantee that. And the final mistake that I've made, and again, something that I would definitely recommend any entrepreneur to follow this recommendation, is to spend a lot more time in each existing customer than what we normally do, which is to try and find new ones. Nurturing an existing customer is not something that you can do, you must do, because again, by the mere definition of what you're doing, it's new. So your customer doesn't know what the heck to do with your solution. Definitely, both of you don't know, realize the full potential of that particular use case with that particular customer. So I would recommend to spend as much time as the customer would allow for any entrepreneur to learn from the customer, to get feedback, to see how they can improve the personal relationship with them, and constantly try to think ahead. Okay, we have accomplished this milestone. What are we doing next? And make sure that you exploit the full potential of this collaboration, because it will be much more valuable than the chances of having another client if you try to spend that time over reaching out to a million more potential ones. So it's whenever this between spending time with existing clients and exploring new opportunities, I personally, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs have done that in the beginning, we tend to shift towards the new opportunities rather than focusing on the existing ones. So this is definitely something that I would recommend to do. And as for your second question, was it about who should become or shouldn't become an entrepreneur?
Yeah, that's right. Because, you know, entrepreneurship is not a journey for everyone. People, like, you know, especially in this internet era, you know, entrepreneurship is glorified, but it's not a path for everybody.
Correct. I don't think that real entrepreneurs have a choice. It's usually for the vast majority, especially people like me, I can tell from my personal experience, for the vast majority, if you're working in a global enterprise like I used to work with, definitely in the beginning, unless you're very successful and lucky, it's a dramatic downgrade of everything that you're used to. And statistically, since most startups fail, that's statistically that's a wrong path to follow. At the same time, I think that entrepreneurs just don't have any other choice. You reach a certain point that you simply have to do it. Being an entrepreneur is about making that dent in the universe that no one in an enterprise, or it's very unlikely that if you work in a big enterprise, of course you have a very important job and you may have an important impact. Like I can tell you that I was responsible for a very specific piece of silicon in Intel's processors, but it was important for a billion customers who use this kind of processor. So it's still important, but it's not going to make a dent. When you work in a big enterprise, you're not going to make a dent. And most people that start a startup, it's with this kind of a mischief that you want to do something that other people cannot do, and you have to go through with it, even though that you know that it's going to be a tedious path. I don't think, I personally didn't look at entrepreneurs as in a glorified way. I don't think that Columbus enjoyed most of his journeys, or Magellan, I'm sure they were miserable for 99.9% of their time on these poor wooden ships. These guys were miserable. Astronauts going to the moon, they're miserable. You're not going to do it because people are not following them because they think that you will enjoy the journey. But you want to make a dent, so it's if you like it or not, you're going to suffer through those troubles trying to make that impact.
I'm very glad that you said that, because if you go onto the internet, entrepreneurship is wonderful and you get these opportunities, which, yes, you get as a result. But on the work up to there, like you said, you're miserable, you're working hard, you're not spending any time with your family and friends. Long hours, your health is probably going to be affected because you're not sleeping properly, or maybe you're eating rubbish food. So I'm very glad that you said that, the blunt truth. So Ziv, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. What one piece of advice would you leave the listeners with today?
I think that we talked about a lot of general advices. I would say that maybe something that will connect between everything. For me personally, the brain is the most amazing thing that we're familiar with. It's more complex than the universe. It has this thing that some material that is built from the same building blocks, just like the rest of the universe, just like the computer we're using and the water that we're drinking, it's made of the same material, but in some miraculous way it generates ideas and thoughts and emotions. To me, that's the biggest mystery that can ever happen. It's the first and last question that human people would ever ask: how is this possible? So I would recommend people to spend time learning about the brain. Anyone that has knowledge in this domain, I would definitely recommend to explore starting up a business or an organization to help in addressing brain-related conditions, because again, there are many millions of people out there who need this kind of support, and it also, I think, has a very good business opportunity. So that would be my recommendation to anyone who is interested in that, to step into this field and become active as best as they can.
Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to episode 56 of the MedTech Podcast. If you have not already done so, please subscribe. If you wish to learn more about Ziv, you can connect with him online or visit his company website, the links of which are provided in the description. If there are any particular topics or guests you'd like for me to have on the show in future, then feel free to reach out.